Our program continues with tape two.
How about this? Maybe there's something wrong with that metaphor, because notice it has to do with planes and transitions. It's an inherently dualist metaphor. How about if we say there is no inside and outside? There is no with or without. You just use what you've got. Whatever works should be used. I spent time in India and visited all these people and so forth and so on, and I just became convinced that unless you were predisposed to believe in this stuff, that it would never carry you where you wanted it to. And one thing about psychedelics, you don't have to be predisposed. It doesn't work for those who believe it works. It works for those who think it doesn't work. Then one last point, and then we'll go on. There's a story, maybe some of you know this story, of a man who lived by the side of a river, and he wanted to cross the river. So he practiced a siddhi of levitation so that he could walk across the water. And it took him 40 years to perfect this siddhi, and finally he could cross the river. And Buddha was preaching in the neighborhood, and the guy came to him and he said, Master, look what I've achieved. I can walk on the water to cross the river. And Buddha said, yeah, but the ferry costs a nickel. And that's the thing. I think we're not going to be able to replace this tool without wasting so much time in the act of replacing it that Armageddon will catch up with us. I think we have to humble ourselves so thoroughly that you have to admit that you can't get where you want to go unless you form a partnership with somebody whose idea of a good time is growing in a cow pie. And if you're willing to partner up with this humble, humble member of the ecosystem, then you and it can fly to glory. Have at it. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend, especially in the late stages of pregnancy, doing anything that is going to wildly perturb you. And you know, LSD was discovered in the act of trying to produce better drugs to induce labor. So that's excellent advice. Honor the fetus. Yeah.
As a biologist,
yeah. Well, the true and honest answer is, how the hell can you find out when they won't let you do research? It's totally insidious. We don't know. We don't know because they will not allow the research to be done. This is one of the reasons why I say that you should stick with shamanically sanctioned plants. Because we know, for instance, that people have been taking psilocybin in the Sierra Mazateca of central Mexico for millennia. They don't show blindness, tumors, miscarriage, madness, cataracts, whatever. That's your human data for that. But you go to, let's talk for a minute about something like ketamine. Nobody knows. Nobody has any data. MDMA seems to be tremendously effective in facilitating interpersonal stuff. That's a psychological issue. Chemically, what kind of data do we have? You know, 6 years worth of data gathered under duress. So to be safe, stick with the things that are sanctioned by human use. And then in some more enlightened future, we will explore these synthetics and find out just what the parameters are. Yeah, finish up. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying take things which have been sanctioned by human usage. I mean, how about a plant like Strychnos nox vomica? I mean, you're dead in a minute and a half. And it's a beautiful, wonderful plant. Why did it kill you? Well, because it's jammed with strychnine. No, it's nothing about its being a plant. It's about having a repeated history of human usage. That's what sanctifies it. Yeah, the lady in magenta.
First of all, I'd like to try to see the woman sitting over here. I deeply respect your position there. Many times in my own search for consciousness, I've wanted to not have to depend on an external catalyst to my broken consciousness. But I would propose that you think about one thing, and that is, I studied plants for the last 22 years, plants as medicine. And what I notice is that there is a particular co-evolution that happens between the plant and the human. And so what I started taking for granted at one point that the mushrooms are going to catalyze the same kind of consciousness that they always have. But not only do the biological climatic situations determine what is going to happen to that mushroom and how it's going to affect your body, but I think that all species are changing consciousness at the same time. So what the generations of mushrooms might have given me years ago when I was 18 years old, that whole species as a whole might be prepared to teach an entirely different, more evolved lesson at this point. And so I'm just trying to catch up a little.
That's really an interesting point. I mean, it never occurred to me, but somebody brought it up to me. They said, have you noticed that the trips are changing? And once you do ask yourself this question, it does seem to be so. And I don't know whether that's a deep assertion. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. For instance, this goddess thing, I don't think people gave the goddess a thought in the early 1970s, late 1960s. Now, people have, some of the least likely people report intense encounters with the goddess. So is it amplifying the general mindset of the society, and so there's more goddess stuff there? Or I don't really know. It's a very interesting question. There are more questions than answers. I mean, this is definitely wide open stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
You discussed our sense of health, which certainly makes sense, is a believable description. And you suggest the use of psychedelics of psilocybin as an antidote to that. But I have trouble seeing a cause and effect relationship as far as what our use or more widespread use might lead to in terms of veering the path.
We're trying to restore the relationship of ego to the other components of the psyche that existed as recently as 12,000 years ago. The ego has become a deadly growth in the historical societies, exacerbated by the phonetic alphabet, monotheism, modern science. This is like you're getting sicker and sicker and sicker as you lay these things on. And so the idea is that if we could restore the original diminished role of the ego that it had for that period, however long it was, that we could begin to solve our problems. Because the problems which face us, put very simply, are going to demand sacrifice. And sacrifice is what the ego doesn't want to hear about. I mean, when you go to somebody and say, look, to save this planet, we're going to have to redistribute income radically. That means everybody in this room is going to have less. We're going to have to honor a whole bunch of cultural positions that we previously just were going to bulldoze over, and so forth and so on. So it's the diminishing of ego by any means necessary that lies to getting any grip on our problems. I mean, if we continue as we are, I think we have probably less than 30 years before life is irreconcilably screwed up. You know, nobody believes that the future is rosy and wonderful. I mean, if you go to the people at the World Bank and the IMF and these people who are straight, you know, suits, all of them, they have a set of curves which would stand your hair on end. When they propagate the curve of population, the curve of toxification of the environment, the curve related to the ozone hole disappearing, you see, you know, it's finished in sometime in the next 50 years. They don't talk about this because they don't want to panic the vast numbers of people who just go to work and raise their kids and pray somebody smarter is doing something about all this. But they don't believe there is any kind of normal future. And I don't either. I think we're going to, that it's business as usual is not on the menu, folks. We're either going to go into an era of immense resource scarcity, regimentation, governmental interference in our lives, tremendous propagandistic efforts to make us do one thing or another, or we're going to pull the plug on scientism and its stooges and the institutions which feed us, feed it. Capitalism is an interesting problem, more easily discussed now that communism is out of the picture. Capitalism is as anti-human a philosophy as you can possibly conceive, because at this very moment we should be consuming less, manufacturing less, selling less, transporting less. And what's the battle cry? Free trade everywhere. What does free trade mean? It means my right to come to your country and sell the most outlandish junk you've ever seen, and you will have no right to turn it away, because in the name of free trade, crapola has to go everywhere. It's really, see, they try to tell you that capitalism and democracy are not at variance. Actually, the whole Marxist-Leninist socialist thing was a side dish. The real life and death struggle is between capitalism and democracy. Democracy says everybody has an innate worth that must be honored. Capitalism says those who die with the most toys win. You cannot reconcile these two things. And nobody wants to talk about this. We're still having the party over the fall of communism. But, you know, you go to the Soviet Union or the former areas of the Soviet Union and you see that what it was a deep freeze for traditional culture. In Kyrgyzia and Turkmenistan, people are basically camel husbandry is what's going on. Now, with communism on the rocks, McDonald's will be there in 5 years and Kmart will be following close behind. So I think we're coming to a great crisis of fundamental, our relation to our own fundamental institutions. I'm not anti-capitalist. I think capitalism needs to sever its connection to materialism. This is, again, why virtual reality is interesting. You sell things made of light, not made of beryllium, metal, brass, steel and wood, but light. We've got all the light we need, but we have to stop making things out of stuff, or we're not going to be around to tell the tale.
In order to get anywhere, we have to have a major shift of values.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that a way to shift our values is the same as logic philosophy. I don't disagree with, but your model has been that everybody in the culture participated in this and were able to shift their values simultaneously and so to cooperate. Are you suggesting, is that the necessary outcome in this case?
No, I think that, you know, revolutions are made by percentages. If 15 or 20% changed, then the example would spread. You see, we are not, psilocybin is the easy way to awaken. You know, take a psychedelic plant and have an experience and get your act together. But the future is full of sledgehammers. It's not going to end with a whimper. It's going to end with a series of thuds and bangs. It could begin almost any time. I mean, we could get a hot, muggy day in Mexico City this summer, and a million people would die. This thing in Los Angeles is a wake-up call. It is going to get uglier and more chaotic and more crazy. There is going to be more starvation, more fascism, more dictatorship. It's unless we do something, until we do something. And it can. How bad is it going to have to get before people say, you know, we're doing something wrong? You know, people dance on the Russians, but you've got to admire people who have the guts to say, we did it entirely wrong, 100%. I mean, can you imagine in this country being able to do, say, you know, I mean, it may be coming. This character from Austin is a peculiar item in the mix. You know, I mean, I for years had a fantasy speech, which I always imagined that I would somehow end up giving. But it's the speech where you say, my fellow Americans, you have been lied to, screwed and abused by these two criminal parties for 100 years. And your only hope is to overthrow the Republicrats and create a decent world to live in. Well, no Republican can make that speech. No Democrat can make that speech and be credible. It has to be somebody who wasn't in bed with either of those forces. So I'm not at all pleased by who apparently will bear the mantle. But on the other hand, if change is what we need, then it's probably not going to be a candidate that you and I can embrace. It's going to be some oddball. So, you know, we have to recognize it when we see it coming. Yeah.
A couple of things. First of all, it seems to me it's an attempt to place the spatial or temporal context, which implicit experience. We have to realize what the assumptions are that go into that. We don't even know what this is.
No, we don't know what it is.
Try to place it into a temporal spatial mode. And it seems to me that it serves us better to leave the question open and have the experience and let the experience tell us what it's about and where we need to go.
Yeah, the great thing about it is it can talk.
Secondly, I'd like to ask a question about time wave zero.
Good for you.
When I first saw you talk about that, it was kind of that was made in Santa Fe, I believe. And I was fascinated by it, and I watched it closely, but as it got to the end of the tape, when I started getting interested in what the significance of a zero crossing was, the tape stopped. So I'd like to, it seems to be a decreasing function of time, which meant that a zero crossing had some singular significance, but I really wonder what, in real terms, a zero crossing is kind of a zero.
Well, probably half at least in the room haven't the faintest idea what this question is about. I've stayed away from this because this is the personalistic stuff where I've created a certain model of reality based on a new way of looking at time. And I don't want to go into it too much tonight, but I want to suggest something to you tonight, which is that, you know, at the very beginning of this talk, we talked about mutation and natural selection. And that's the Darwin's insight was vast and deep. And what he offered was an explanation for how rainbow trout come to be, monarch butterflies, redwood trees, herds of elephants, so forth and so on. What it doesn't address is us. We are the weird bird on the block. I mean, yes, we're some kind of monkey, but when you stand us next to our nearest relative, it's very, very clear that it is not a very near relative. It doesn't look like us much, certainly doesn't act like us. what's the deal with human beings? And I think that, you know how all these religions, these Western religions, have built in this idea of the end of the world, and they're always running around expecting the Messiah or something. And this, to the scientific mind, is just the final proof of the pudding that these people have water between the ears. Because science just says, you know, that's just ridiculous. I mean, but I wonder. I mentioned just a minute ago these curves that when you propagate them into the future, everything leads to the unimaginable, and it's all within the next 50 years. So I sort of think, as human beings, as analogous to iron filings on a piece of paper, and you shake these iron filings out of a salt shaker or something, and there they lie, randomly arranged in heaps. Well, then you come underneath the paper with a very powerful magnet, and lo and behold, these little iron filings coherently arrange themselves into this beautiful double mustache pattern, which I'm sure you've all seen. Well, I think that there is an enormous punchline to the historical process that very, very few people suspect. And that what history is, it's what happens to an animal who falls under the influence of a kind of strange attractor. And that we are being pulled into a well of transformative intentionality. History is not pushed by the casuistry of war, migration, imperial dynastic families and stuff like that. History is pulled toward an unimaginable something which is continuously trying to mirror itself in us. This is why these Egyptians said, you know, I don't know what it is, but I just think we should really build a big, simple building. They say, I don't know why, but I'm going to enslave 50,000 people and do it, and don't ask me why. And this is, and you know, this is the same force that reared Chartres Cathedral. This is the same force that created the space shuttle. We are in a relationship to an unseen something which we keep trying to image with our mythologies, our religions, our technologies, our epiphanies. And I think that it's not so far away, that it isn't 10,000 years in the future. It is sometime in the next 50 years, and that this is what history was for. You see, history is an incredibly peculiar and brief phenomenon. I mean, viewed from the point of view of biology, it's less time than it takes for a new species to emerge. I mean, let's call history 25,000 years. You know, in frame one, you're chipping flint. In frame two, you're hurling an instrument toward Alpha Centauri. Like that, this happened. Well, what's happening? It's that mind itself is being pulled out of this creature, and it's being given hands and languages and symbolic systems in order to image the unspeakable. The unspeakable, I call it the transcendental object at the end of time. It casts, and it's in another dimension, it's in a kind of super space. And what it casts into history is the enormous shadow of its immanence. This is what straight people call God. This is what all these visionaries are raving about. It's that when you sink beneath the surface of ordinary causality and mundane ho-humism, what you discover is this enormous transcendental object, which you could call it, you know, the Sacred Heart of Jesus, or the flying saucer, or the Philosopher's Stone. It's all of those things, and much, much more. It's not only stranger than you suppose, it's stranger than you can suppose. And it has called us out of animal organization over a 25,000-year period. We hang in the balance, and then we meet it. And we're going to meet it. That's the light at the end of that birth canal of transcendence that I referred to. And now I see that our song is sung, our time is done. Thank you very, very much for turning in.